for joining us for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget segment. Today's special guest, G. Edward Griffin, author of The Creature from Jekyll Island. The U.S. dollar continues to be plagued by fiscal irresponsibility and monetary profligacy. Our special guest today thinks that the greenback's days may be numbered. A new currency is inevitable. G. Edward Griffin, author of several best-selling hits, including, of course, The Creature from Jekyll Island, and he runs the Reality Zone with Joan Hunter. Welcome back, Mr. Griffin.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
You know, I wonder if we could start off with the U.S. dollar. You know, the halls of history, I think you'd agree, are lined with the carcasses of defunct currencies. The once mighty pound eventually gave way, the sterling, to the dollar. You seem to think the dollar may have to pass the torch as well, that its zenith could be approaching. A new currency might replace it.
Yes, the phrase passing the torch triggered a couple of thoughts. In the past, that was pretty much the case, that there was always one currency in the world or more that had some real value to it in the form of the productivity of the society, or preferably in the form of some kind of backing in terms of gold or silver, so that the money itself had some intrinsic value that was recognized universally for something other than money, which is what gives money its real backing. Money can survive and be accepted quite well for long periods of time, provided that the nation issuing it is a strong military force and can dominate the world. And you know, you better like us, or we'll send our troops over there and we'll call you terrorists or something. You know, that works for a long time, but then it fades, and maybe people get tired of playing that game, and those countries tend to overspend themselves, they become weak, and then they're replaced by another strong nation. So the torch was passed in the past, but today we're going through something a little bit different, and that is that all currencies in the world now are, the flame is going out, you might say, in the torch. Who are you going to pass it to? You might say, well, China, maybe, or maybe the Leninist bloc, you know. Who knows? Maybe there's some group in the Middle East that will back its currency by gold. They talk about that, but it's not really happened on any scale. So what's happening today, Chris, is that the bankers of the world who really now create the money, it's not the nations of the world anymore. It's the bankers that create the money. And anybody that has read my book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, they would know how that works. But we can come back to that perhaps later. The banks create the money in the name of the nation, and the money is just it's credit money and backed by debt. So all of these bankers now have played that game, and they've used it quite effectively to transfer wealth to themselves and their institutions. And now that process has gone about as far as it can go, because there isn't much more left, you know, to transfer. It's moving rapidly off in one direction. And so now what? Now what's the end game of that? And so all of these bankers and these various systems have been working together for quite some time to create a new currency, and it will not be a national currency this time. It will be an international currency. First, a regional currency like the euro. You know, that was the first step to get the currencies of Europe into a regional common currency produced by the European market, the European Union. And they're working on it, of course, in North America. They're calling it the AMERO. For the United States, Canada, and Mexico, and that's not happened yet, but they're pushing it as hard as they can. And the grand design on all this is that after these regional currencies are established in Europe, North America, Asia, Africa, and the Pacific Rim, and so forth, and they have all of them in place, working on them, then the next step, after maybe 20 or 25 years, when that currency blows up and it suffers from the same fate of all fiat currencies, then they're going to transist into a international currency. Who knows what it'll be called, but perhaps it'll be called the Bangkor. And then that's the end of the road, because there'll be no torch to pass. There'll be nobody to accept the new torch. The whole world will be saddled with one currency. It'll be essentially the same in character as all of the little fiat currencies that have been used by the various nations of the world But it's the end of the process, because now the world is globalized, as they say. It's all one governance. It's all one currency, all one military force. It's all one world government, and that's the end of the line.
Well, that's a very succinct and tactful overview of what's going on, but I'd like more about how we got to this point. I mean, how we received the torch, and you alluded to that. You said you might be interested in maybe giving folks a primer here on just what the mechanisms are over the, let's say, the last century that led us to this point. Much of what's been fed to us in the mainstream may not be as accurate as we once thought. People are looking for answers. They want to know this topic of the evils of capitalism. I mean, we seem to run into this everywhere, but is it that maybe what we think of as modern capitalism has been mangled to such a point that, you know, that our forefathers wouldn't even recognize what we call capitalism today?
Yeah, those are two real meaty topics. I'm tempted to deal with that second one and forget the first one, but I guess we need to start first places first. Don't let me forget to get back to this so-called capitalism. But the history of how we got to where we are is a fascinating one. You said it's been going on for a century. The process is several centuries old. It started here in the United States a century ago. But the process has a code name to it that is used in the financial industry. They call it the central bank. That's the instrument or the institution that is, that brings this to us, you know, coming to your country soon by a national or rather a central bank. And they call that thing a central bank. Our Federal Reserve is a central bank, and it's modeled after the Bank of England, which is the granddaddy, the original central bank. And all that means, central has some meaning because it means it's centralized and the power and the authority is all brought together in one place. It is a bank in a sense that people go to it and they use it as the medium for their transactions. They put their money into the bank, they borrow money from the bank and so forth, and all of that. So In the modern sense, it is a bank. In the traditional sense, it's not, because what you put in there has no value. It's just an accounting program more than anything else. It's nothing of value. It's just numbers. But it's true. It's old. It's a couple of centuries old. And what a central bank really is, if you strip out the code name and just describe it in plain English, is that it's a cartel. It's a cartel of banks. It's in most countries, it's more than just one bank. It's several commercial banks that have come together and formed a cartel to protect their own interests. And then because they are so fabulously wealthy and they control the money system, they have unseen influence over the politicians in those countries. They literally buy and sell them like so many pounds of raw hamburger. And that part is not too visible to the average citizen. But when you think about it, he who has the money makes the rules. Well, the banks not only have the money, they make the money. And so they buy the politicians, and the politicians pass the laws that make everything that the banks, everything that they do, they make it legal. The same things that would be terribly illegal if you or I were doing it. We can't just go make money out of nothing and then put it into circulation and loan it out at interest. That's mainly what the central bank does. And they pay off the politicians and say, hey, this is all in the best interest of the nation. This is what we call credit. This is the modern banking system. And without it, we'll all be living in caves and eating meat. So everybody goes along with it. That's a central bank. It's a cartel, a group of private banks that literally control the money system, and because of that, they have great influence, if not total control, over their respective governments. So that's how we got there. In 1913, our central bank was passed into law. It was called the Federal Reserve System, but it was really modeled after the Bank of England. And when you look at the Federal Reserve, it is a cartel. It is not a government agency, although they went out of their way when they formed it in 1913. They went out of their way to make it look like a government agency. You know, they called it Federal Reserve, makes it federal. It's about as federal as FedEx. And they have no reserves to speak of. It's all kind of a smoke and mirrors game. So we got there because the banks decided that they wanted to get ahead of the parade. And what I mean by that is that back in 1910, when they started to work on this, from 1910 to 1913, when this plan was put into operation, there was a hue and cry among the American people who wanted banking reform. They knew that there was too much power in Wall Street. They knew that these banks had too much control over credit and the economic flow and ebb of money in the society, and they wanted Congress to control those big bad banks, you know? And so the bankers decided, hey, why do we sit around and wait for Congress to do something and pass laws to regulate our industry? Let us be the ones that drafts that law to control our industry. And so they met in secret on Jekyll Island back in 1910. They prepared the basic outline of their cartel agreement of how they wanted their system to be operated by them, not by anybody else, not by the government. And then they took that cartel agreement to Washington, and they wrote across the top of that agreement the words Federal Reserve Act. Convinced them that they should pass their cartel agreement into law, which they did. And so now, by December, the end of December in 1913, the cartel agreement of the banking cartel became law. And ever since, you and I have had to abide by those terms, or we go to prison. And since it was passed into law, And there are prison penalties for disobeying that agreement. Everybody thinks it's a government agency, but only government can send you to prison, right? Well, no, wrong. The banks do. And so that, in a nutshell, is how we got there. It was trickery from the top to bottom. It was fraud and deceit, and it still is. It's even worse now than it ever was. And if you ever wonder what's really going on, just look at these bailouts and all these huge economic programs that they're passing in Congress. So they want $1 billion here and $1 trillion there to bail out the banks or bail out the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and bail out all of the savings and loan institutions and bail out General Motors, who have these huge loans to the banks, and they bail out Mexico, and they bail out other countries who have these huge loans to the banks and to keep those interest payments coming. And you look at all of this and you scratch your head, and if you forget the words that the politicians are using, like, we're doing this for you folks, we're doing this to save the system, we're doing this to save America, we're doing this, you know, for all these good reasons, so that children will have milk and all that sort of thing. But when you look at the result, where does that money go? Well, it goes to the banks. Every bit of it goes to the banks. And then you think, aha, I get it now. This is a banking cartel we're dealing with. And it's as simple as that.
But there's so many interesting facets to the story. For instance, originally, this was done covertly, I'm sure you agree, but I mean, my goodness, they're doing it right in front of our faces today. I mean, Goldman Sachs, they call it government Sachs at the Treasury Department now, because there's so many former key executives in the organization in Washington, D.C. There were other freedom fighters. You know, most people point to Thomas Jefferson and some of the others who warned of central banks, and they'd just seen what happened in the French Revolution and the heads rolling in the streets of Paris. Andrew Jackson comes to mind, the great central bank warrior, based his presidency on defeating the central banks. And it only took them a few more decades before they finally had the noose around our necks.
Yeah, the history is very, very strong with examples of this ongoing conflict. As you've just said, this is quite historical. It does go back a couple of centuries. And it's reaching the end game, though, and that's how we started this discussion. This only can go through so many cycles before it changes character, and it's reaching at the end of the game now, so that the character will change. It's not going to be just another economic cycle from which everybody recovers. You know, it's not just another depression and boom bust cycle, all of that sort of thing. People take comfort in thinking, well, it's bad now, but it's been bad before, you know, and we always recover, don't we? This is a strong nation. Americans won't stand for any of this very much longer, you know, because these are good people and all that. And it's a comforting thought. But when you really look at the details of this historic fabric, you see that we're coming to the end of the rug. We're at the edge of the rug now, and the fabric is changing. And when we get off of the rug, we're into a whole new system. And that's what's really scary to me. As long as you can just look at it as a historical play on the stage, you know, it's fascinating, it's interesting. And you can say, well, I learned a lesson from that, and maybe I can protect myself and my family, and maybe, you know, we can do better. Maybe we can even take advantage of this, because it's possible along the way for people who are very smart and who understand this cycle to take advantage of it and make money while everyone else is losing money. But at the end of that process, you're off the rug, you're off the fabric, and you're onto the hard cement now. And I think that's, we're coming to that point. And let me explain what that means in my mind, at least. I think that the system is so strained that it will not be able to operate much longer as it has in the past. It is rapidly moving toward a command economy, such as we have seen very graphically in the Soviet Union. And even though they drop that for a while, they're returning to it also. All nations of the world now are returning to the Soviet style of administering economic and social policies and political policies. So we're coming now to a new stage in world history, for where the whole world is going definitely tyrannical. It's going into despotism, it's totalitarianism, and when you can no longer produce anything on the basis of economics, you know, that people want to go to work and they want to produce things because they have a profit motive, and they can provide for themselves by working hard and being innovative. When all that comes to an end, the only way you can make people work is to force them at the point of a bayonet. And, you know, you can herd them into trucks and put them into FEMA camps or work camps, or we used to call those concentration camps, but in Germany they called them work camps. You know, those, you get an impression that all those people in the concentration camps in Germany were just there to be slaughtered and gassed, and that's not true. They were there to work. Those were where huge factories were located, and those poor people were, most of them, were put into slave labor, and that's what goes on in China, too. So anyway, the world, I'm trying to get to the point, is the world is moving in that direction now, because only when the economy finally collapses and nothing works anymore, the only thing that's left is the raw power of physical force. And that's what scares me to death, because this is a new chapter in world history. And this time around, it'll be global. And so there would be no place to go and no one to whom to pass the torch.
Think about Orwell's 1984, the playbook for the powers that be today. They learned the lessons. You know, we have to admit that our overseers, if you will, learn from their own mistakes. And I think what they learned from those camps that you've referred to, and it wasn't just, by the way, World War II, and we can go back to all of European history and see the pogroms and so many horrible times where minorities and other outcasts were put into groups and forced into labor, or worse, serfdom, if you will, were hoodwinked into thinking, well, if I just pay my taxes, maybe I can beat this inflation. Oh, wait a minute, now the cost of goods have gone up so much higher, I can barely make ends meet. And then suddenly one little illness, one little accident on the way, the commute to work, and the whole house of cards implodes. There's no safety net. What contingencies can the everyday listener, the everyday investor, steps we can make to prepare now to help shield our families and friends against what we see coming?
That's a very important issue, and I'd like to address it, and I will. But before doing so, I'd like to point to a very important overview of this, which is that we'll be talking about short-term versus long-term preparation. What can you do on the short-term? What can you do for the long-term? The short term is pretty easy. It's right out of the textbooks. You know, you try and get out of debt, unless you're making money through debt, of course, and you're very confident that you can continue to sustain the debt and to pay the overhead. But to try and get out of debt, you certainly don't go into debt for consumption. You don't go into debt to take a trip around the world. Live within your means. You try and get off the track of the train wreck. And by that, I mean, we know that inflation is the great destroyer of fiat money around the world, and the United States is no exemption, has no exemption. So we're on the track, and we know that our money is going down, down, down in value every day, and yet we're saving money, right? And every day that our little nest egg gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and it's like being on this track, and you see this train coming down the track. I better get off this track, because if I keep all my savings and what little wealth I have in the form of money, like in a bank account or in an insurance policy, anything that's denominated in dollars, I'm going to be wiped out by that train. So the first thing is, hey, get off the track. Whatever savings you have, put as much of it as you can into something other than inflatable money. So that's the number one piece of advice I would give. And whatever that is, it sort of depends on your preferences. Gold and silver have always been a very good choice, but there are other choices too. You know, hard inventories are always good. Somebody said cynically the other day that they think that the best currency of the coming era will be bullets. And I had to stop and think, oh, wow, that's a very cynical, pessimistic view. But I had to say, you know, I'm afraid you're right. but you get the point that, you know, paper money will go the way of all other fiat money has always gone in history. So if you're depending on that for your future, you're making a big mistake. Now, the long view, however, though, is we must save the system, or we must change the system. We must get this collectivist mentality out of the minds of the people, people who believe that the group is more important than the individual, that the government is the representative of society, and the government is this great solver of all problems, and the government will take care of us, and if we can't provide for our health care, then the government should do that. If we can't provide for our housing, then the government should provide that. If we can't pay for education, then the government should do that. If we don't have enough food, well, the government should give us food stamps, and on and on and on. And this process, it has been going on, and you end up at that stage, and the first thing you know, we're totally dependent on government for everything. And if we're totally dependent on government, we can never be free, because you know, the hand that feeds you is the hand that controls you.
G. Edward Griffin, always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and good luck to you, and good wishes to your listeners.